Fellow workers, you're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane 88.1 and 92.3 FM Thin Air Community Radio. You've reached Solidarity Spokane, and I'm your host, Kat Sabotage. We broadcast acknowledging that we are on the ancestral lands of the Spokane Tribe of Indians and a multitude of tribes who are connected through shared history of trade, celebration, and resources. We make this acknowledgement to pay respects to their elders past and present, whose knowledge remains on these lands. Please take a moment to consider the many legacies of violence, displacement, migration, and settlement that bring us together today. Join our community as we continue to learn about such truths that we can take direct actions in solidarity with Native people towards restorative justice. Welcome to the show, where every day is Labor Day, but today does require special attention. The first Labor Day was celebrated on Tuesday, September 5th, 1882, in New York City. It began as a gradual recognition of individual states and finally culminated in federal recognition of the holiday on June 28th, 1894, after more than 30 states had adopted it. Initially, parades were commonplace as a way to demonstrate the spirit and the power of the American worker. In its early days, all workers were encouraged to strike to ensure they got the day off, as it was only available to federal workers, and it was meant to further the notion that labor creates all wealth, and without their participation, this country cannot function. There is a sterile acknowledgement of the value of the American worker on the website of the American Department of Labor that reads, "American labor has raised the nation's standard of living and contributed to the greatest production the world has ever known. And the labor movement has brought us closer to the realization of our traditional ideas of economic and political democracy. It is important, therefore, that the nation pays tribute on Labor Day to the creator of so much of the nation's strength, freedom, and leadership, the American worker," end quote. You've got to forgive me if I got to stop and laugh at so paltry a recognition by our government. May 1st is International Workers' Day, and it is celebrated in over 80 other countries as the day to recognize the contribution of labor. So why not here at home? May 1st has held significance in Europe since ancient times, marking the beginning of summer. Symbolically, it's important to understand why a celebration marking the beginning of summer and the passing of winter is relevant to the laborers of the world, who have toiled in the dark for many centuries and fought tooth and nail for even moderate advancement of their rights and their economic liberty. It was adopted by the Second International in 1889 as International Workers' Day to commemorate the Haymarket Affair in Chicago and the struggle for the eight-hour day. Haymarket, as many of you may know, lives in infamy. Also known as the Haymarket Massacre, it was a labor demonstration gone awry, or sabotaged. A, quote, unknown person, end quote, threw a bomb at the police as they acted to disperse the meeting, and this resulted in the deaths of 7 police officers and 4 civilians. 8 anarchist labor leaders were targeted and blamed for the event. Their names are August Spies, Albert Parsons, George Engel, Adolf Fischer, Louis Ling, Michael Schwab, Oscar Niebe, and Samuel Fielden. All but Niebe were sentenced to die. 4 of these men, Spies, Parsons, Engel, and Fischer, were hanged on November 11, 1887. Despite only 2 of them being present at the demonstration and a surprising lack of evidence for their direct involvement in what had begun as a peaceful demonstration and their compliance with police orders to disperse. I have a short excerpt from a book called Labor's Untold Story by Richard O. Boyer and Herbert M. Moraes that describes the execution. Quote, "The execution room was crowded with officials and reporters when the 4 men were led in. They stood straight and proud above their accusers, somehow seeming very tall in their white shrouds on the scaffold high above the heads of the witnesses. There was something exalted in their manner as they took their places, each beneath a dangling noose, and more than one witness likened them to John Brown and his men, who had also died for mankind. As the deputy pulled down a mask before the face of August's spies, the condemned man spoke a single sentence. "There will come a time," he said, "when our silence will be more powerful than the voices that you strangle today." "This is the happiest moment of my life," Fisher said, and Engel shouted, "Hurrah for anarchy." Parsons, his voice boomed out, asking if he might speak, "Will I be allowed to speak, O men of America?" "Let me speak, Sheriff Mattson. Let the voice of the people be heard." He tried to go on, but the trap was sprung. In hanging Parsons, spies Fisher and Engel, the big monopolists of the day were directing their blows not so much at the men themselves or the movement they represented, but at the much more potent force of organized working people in the country. It was the labor movement in general, and the Knights of Labor in particular, that they were determined to crush. As a Chicago businessman declared in referring to Parsons and his associates, end quote, "No, I don't consider these people to be guilty of any offense, but they must be hanged. I'm not afraid of anarchy. Oh no, it's the utopian scheme of a few philanthropic cranks who are amiable with all, but I do consider that the labor movement must be crushed. The Knights of Labor will never dare to create discontent again if these men are hanged," ending quote. If the industrialists had not hired the unknown person who threw the bomb at the Haymarket, they at any rate profited from its throwing, immediately and skillfully using it for a terrific assault against labor. "The bomb that was flung by unknown hands," wrote John Swinton, "has been a godsend to all the enemies of the labor movement. They have used it as an explosive against all the objects that the working people are bent on accomplishing and in defense of all the evils that capital is bent on maintaining. The historical perspective," wrote William Dean Howells, "is that this free republic has killed four men for their opinions. All is over now, except the judgment that begins at once for every unjust and evil deed and goes on forever," end quote. The conviction of the Haymarket Eight and the execution of four prominent leaders of the labor movement was widely, widely condemned. Oscar Wilde, George Bernard Shaw, and poet William Morris strongly admonished the actions of the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois, among many, many others. Despite the hope that the ruling class and the murderers of these four men would cool the advances of the organizations of workers in the country, it had the opposite effect. Progressive governor of Illinois, John Peter Altgeld, signed pardons for the surviving members of the Haymarket Eight, noting that there had been no compelling evidence to demonstrate the connection of the men accused to whomever threw the bomb, including those who were murdered. He further cited the complete lack of acknowledgement for the lethal force which was brought again and again and again by Pinkerton agents against peaceful assemblies of workers for decades. This action and his further support of the labor movement ensured that Governor Altgeld was defeated in his bid for re-election. So what's the point? Why do I go on about Haymarket? Well, in keeping with traditional centrist values of government, President Grover Cleveland, everyone's favorite and heart stopper, worried that endorsing the federal holiday of Labor Day on May 1st would encourage and inflame the socialist and anarchist elements of society, draw too clear a line to the Haymarket affair, and thus supported the establishment of Labor Day in September. He was not the only one. To be clear, the rationale for adopting Labor Day in September was made with the explicit goal to stamp out the possibility that workers would organize and demand better treatment, or agitate, as has been coined in the press. Apparently, a subsistence of living is agitating to some. In an era when tenements were commonplace, children labored for less than a dollar a day, workplace death was accepted as a cost of doing business, and the robber barons of the Gilded Age imported marble for their castles by the ton, while Americans without land or the means of production were forced to sell their bodies on the labor market to eke out a pitiful and meager subsistence. I wish I could tell you that things have changed greatly today. In the U.S., we celebrate Labor Day on the first Monday in September to further obscure and divorce the labor movement from our history. They don't want you to know it. And what an astounding success it has been. Ask the layperson today if they have a notion of who Bill Haywood, Clarence Darrow, Eugene Debs, Lucy Parsons, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, or Mother Jones are. Each worthy of a show in their own right, or a Netflix special. Strange, though, you will never see one. Most won't be able to tell you who they are. And this was one of the stated aims of the Red Scares. They want us to forget the men and women who fought and bled for our rights as human beings. Not Americans, not Frenchmen, not Englishmen, human beings. You don't need to pick up a gun and go to war to defend liberty. The actions of our Supreme Court, who have time and again ruled against the worker and used every power at its disposal to disenfranchise workers seeking representation in the workplace and siding with wealth and power over and over again. Our own Congress, who has refused to adopt legislation that would ensure that workers' wages kept up with the increase in productivity and the cost of living, and our bosses, who fight tooth and nail to pay as little as possible while taking as much as they can for themselves and disregard employees' basic economic needs, are all working against us. Today, many fellow workers in the lower of the two new classes of American society are working. Despite the lip service that today is for them, they provide luxury services and amenities to the ruling class who vacation on their boats. Make no mistake, my fellow workers, you now live in one of two Americas. Inequality is at its highest level in American history. Tens of millions of us are underinsured or completely uninsured. The cost of college tuition, a prerequisite for gainful work in the economy, has ballooned to saddle any graduate with enough debt to last through most of their adult life. The cost of necessary goods and services has likewise ballooned to ensure that all of us are servants of debt. They've turned us into wage slaves. Our media is replete with humorous satire, highlighting the desperation and hopelessness that are now commonplace in so many of our hearts. We are intimidated with threats of homelessness and poverty, kept so precarious that one tragedy would see us lose our autonomy and force us to relinquish our independence or face certain destitution. One in two of my generation is living at home with their family because we can't afford the cost of freedom and independence. All while, the incomes of the ruling class have ballooned to grotesque dimensions. Hunger and want are found in every county, in every city of our country. And that is why today on Solidarity Spokane, we declare Labor Day effectively dead until we receive recompense. It is a pittance and a charade, an abominable attempt to assuage workers' discontent. They took our history from us, and we want it back. But in every storm, there is a ray of light. Today, across the nation, ordinary people are saying enough is enough. They are exercising their rights and standing up again to fight the economic despotism that has been imposed on them by institutions of finance and greed. This is no time to be a spectator. The Fed is still raising interest rates. They tell you it is to curtail inflation and to get it below 2.3%, but make no mistake, they still raise it with the goal now to curb the strength of the American labor market. They seek to place us back in a situation of precarity and take away our ability to collectively act for a redress of our grievances. Well, like the founding fathers, we dissent. It is our patriotic and civic duty to oppose corporate demagoguery and exploitation. We, the workers of the United States, declare this country to be ours as we have built it, all of it, generation by generation through blood, loss, and sacrifice. And now we sit marginalized, ostracized, landless, bereft of health care, bereft of economic liberty, and saddled with imprisoning debt, trying to find some joy without acknowledging that for many of us, we will be old or dead before this system rights itself. We may not be able to afford a meager home. We may not be able to afford children or health care. We may not be able to afford illness or a break from the dehumanizing exploitation we endure, but we will not sit idle as the country we and our forebears built uses us as vessels to extract more money for the wealthy while they leave us to starve alone in the dark. Joe Atord said, "The worker with their hands in their pockets has more power than the entire ruling class. Without us, they starve alone in the dark. Even without them, owners, bosses, institutions which fail to justify themselves, society would endure." To my millennial friends, do not despair while we have each other. We may just be the lost generation, but though we have been abused, ridiculed, and demeaned by a generation that never saw a country so good to them, though we are the highest educated and most underpaid, overtaxed, underinsured, and overworked, let us be the point at which this abuse stops. Let us be the generation to act in opposition to greed and inhuman institutions of oppression and reach out to one another in solidarity and shirk the ostracizing shackles of the dogmatic American individualism. Fight the urge to sink into seclusion. Fight the media telling you that to be alone is natural. We are communal beings. We are strong together. Stand in solidarity with your friends and defend them. Stand in solidarity with your love and defend it. Stand in solidarity with others and defend others like you who are fighting every day just to make ends meet. Let us stand together and win back our day, our history, and our voice. Happy Labor Day. After the break, I'm very pleased to and honored to have Jordan Sermonera on the program. He has an upcoming comedy special at the Garland Movie Theater. We're going to take a hard pivot from that opening message. We're going to laugh a little right after this.
Join me, Captain Maeve, as we head out and about, featuring LGBTQ folk, friends, allies, and all who make Spokane a better place through inclusion, creativity, truth, and beauty. Local stories, conversations, and creations with universal appeal. Out and about, every Tuesday at 4 p.m. on KYRS.
This is your KYRS live and local calendar for September 4th through the 7th. Monday, Trailer Park Girls, Costa La Vista, The Colorflies, Ben Vogel, and many others at Pig Out in the Park, Wild Wooly at Walter's Fruit Ranch, Starlight Motel at the Brick West Plaza, the Spokane Symphony at Comstock Park, Band of Horses at the Knitting Factory, and Open Mic at Jackson Street. Tuesday, Shuffle Dogs at Litz's and the Nightmares at Zola. Wednesday, Diary at Iron Horse in the Valley, Quail Jam at Barn and Blossom, Nalina McShane at Kendall Yard's Night Market, the Rusty Jackson Band at the Valley Eagles, Joel Haugen at the Osprey, Open Mic at the Checkerboard, and the Roommates Jam at the Red Room. Thursday, Carly Osika at Rocky Hill Park, the Jared Hall Quartet at Emma Roo's, Just Plain Darren at QQ Sushi, Spare Parts at Arborcrest, B at Magnolia American Brasserie, Kyle Richard and Friends at Brick West Plaza, and Thursday Night Jam at Chan's Red Dragon downtown. For an entire hour of Spokane area musicians, tune into For the Love of the Music every Sunday night at 8 on KYRS.
Americans interested in contacting their U.S. senators can find the Senate's website online at senate.gov. From there, click on the drop-down menu on the top left corner of the page. Scroll down until you see the name of your state. Click on the state's name, and the website will redirect you to a page that lists both of the state's senators and their contact information.
Hi, this is Jeremy Whittington from Stage Left Theater. KYRS Thin Air Community Radio provides our region with information that might be omitted, overlooked, or even censored by mainstream media. Your radio station is powered by the communities they serve, and our radio programs are as rich and diverse as the Spokane community itself. Please make a pledge today by texting GIVE KYRS to 44321. Your support ensures that KYRS can continue to celebrate the rich diversity of our community.
Touring comedian recording first stand-up special at Historic Garland Theater. Coming to Spokane with over 10 years of stand-up experience, comedian Jordan Sermonera has worked with clubs and independent venues across North America. September 7th at 8 p.m., he's set to record his much-anticipated debut comedy album, Cutting It Up, as a part of the new First Friday Thursday's Funny, Funny, Funny Joke, Joke, Joke series at the Garland Theater. Fresh off being a featured performer at the 15th annual Asheville Comedy Festival in North Carolina, Sermonera plans to demonstrate exactly what it is to be a Midwest small town class town turned coast to coast cut up. Expect to get your fill of animated bits full of silly voices, absurd act outs, 90s nostalgia, and unforgettable stories that are only his to tell. To be a part of the live audience for this up-and-coming comedian's milestone event that will be released in every conceivable format and distributed in all possible ways, you can find tickets and information through his personal website at thejokeisonme.com. Jordan, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Dallas. Very nice to be here with you. I did not know we were going to burn it all down when we met yesterday, so that was a nice 20-minute opener there. I got excited.
I'm happy to have a co-pilot while we seek to do that.
Absolutely. I found myself March 13th, 2020, dishonorably discharged from the service industry, so that was something I had to deal with personally, you know? Yeah. Waiting tables, bartending, 15 years, and pandemic, they just didn't seem to have a place for me anymore, and that was pretty wild. That was it was jarring for me, because that was what I was used to. I was definitely the proletariat, if you will, hanging out, just serving people meals I can't afford. And now this is what I'm doing, stand-up comedy. I had to go all in, didn't have any choice anymore, because I can't go back to that. It is pretty degrading. I think I've worked every Labor Day of my adult life thinking, what does this mean? And to hear everything that you just shared with me and your audience, I was like, wow, I think the layperson doesn't know anything about that. And it is pretty eye-opening to see things like that trying to be swept under the rug.
And we find ourselves in those places of precarity. I forget who it was that had a statement where somebody is always attributed to coining a term or something, so I can't use it and claim that it's mine, but the precariat. And we have lived so much of our lives in that state where we're just trying to get by and we're just trying to find a place from A to B. And we're just trying to live a decent life. It's not like we're asking for the keys to the kingdom here. But I think I was in the same position, you know, March working as an administrative assistant, found myself in a position where I did not know what was going to happen. And I think COVID really did force a lot of us to kind of reckon with our own paths and where we're going and what we want our country to look like. And it's hard to be grateful for that kind of event, especially in the presence of so much death and loss. But I do think that good comes out of everything, so it is important to recognize what it has done for the labor movement.
Absolutely.
While you were working in the service industry, was that where you discovered that you had a propensity for comedy?
No, man. I grew up in a small town in Kansas where I was very much a class clown, and that I think I, you know, in a place like that where Not a lot of good happening, not a lot going on. And I feel like for the most part, it was, you know, it wasn't the worst upbringing, but it was overall kind of morose and boring. There was nothing to do. And all the people around you, you know, addicts and things like that. And it's just this, you're continually in environments where it's like no one here is living their best life. And I think being able to perceive that from a young age, I realized that the thing for me that was the most fun was to try to have fun no matter what. Mm-hmm. Try to get my friends to laugh, try to razz people up. I was constantly getting letters sent home to my mom about being disruptive and things like that. And it was just because I was looking for the laugh, you know. When things are hard, I think it's what we have to lean on, you know. Comedy's gotten me personally through everything. And to make other people laugh and share a moment with someone where we can forget about all of this very heavy stuff, mm-hmm, continually getting worse, in my opinion. There's We are not recovering in any way. Things are pretty bleak right now when you really look at things. But you don't have to. I think that we can look away from it, try our best to take care of the people that are closest to us, mm-hmm. and prepare for a future that might not be what our parents thought it might have been, or the generation before them, where they were convinced we lived in the greatest country in the world. I think that we can step outside of ourselves and look at America and realize that we've got a lot of problems right now. And so for me, I felt like the last thing I wanted to do in my mid-30s was try my hardest to get back into an industry that was abusive and knew that I depended on it and exploited my time. You know, it was never about my time. It was what the restaurant needed. And if I couldn't fulfill what they needed from me, I would have easily been let go because there's so many people looking for work. But it, for me, that was the easiest route. It was a place where I could talk to people and exchange those moments of like, hey, we're having dinner, but we could also have fun. You know, mm-hmm. that would mm-hmm. be fun. And I do think that in my, I worked at one specific restaurant that was a higher end restaurant after I graduated from college in Lawrence, Kansas. And it was a higher end place where like faculty from the university would come, and anybody who had made something of themselves that had graduated from that university would come back and bring their friends there and ball out, you know, have their big dinner. And it was a place that by reputation was a really good restaurant. But when I started there, it was on its decline. So the mm-hmm. clientele was always like, I remember this place being better. And it's like, this is all I've ever known. It's been on fire since I got here, you know.
But thank you for the compliment.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And that was, I think that's where I kind of learned about crowd work. I feel like I remember getting into comedy when I was about 26. I'm 37 now. And I remember being like, oh God, I wish I would have found out that this was an option so much earlier. I wasted all this time. And in retrospect, I realized that, you know, that 5-year period I spent at that restaurant, I was dealing with clientele where I had to read the room. You know, I had to come up to a table and discern whether or not these people were here for strictly business or if they were ready to have a fun time with me. And I got good at that. You know, if it's a 4 guys who got nothing to give back to you other than, you know, get me my stuff and get out of my face, cool. I can do that for you. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you get the dad jokes going on with some old guy who hasn't been talked to for a long time. Then we're going to have fun, you know? Okay, this guy likes to be silly. I can be silly. And I also got into the situation where I've never had a problem talking to anyone.
Right.
And so we had like a third floor where we would do private parties of up to like 60, 70 people. And they would always put me on those parties because they know that I was capable of being completely shameless. And you know, just, hey, here's the deal, guys. We can either have a good time and an easy time. You need to figure out what you want. And it's just, I think it really built my public speaking skills and allowed me to find, I one time at a table, there was a guy whose brother was the CEO, VP of College Humor, if you remember that website.
I do.
And he was like, man, have you ever considered doing comedy? And I was like, I wouldn't know how to do that because I live in a place with no access to comedy, you know? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he was really nice to give me that guy's phone number. And I had a conversation with that guy one day and he asked me how long I'd been doing comedy. And I was like, I haven't, you know, I'm just a funny guy. And he gave me some recommendations of like, where are you at? I was like, I'm in Lawrence, Kansas. He's like, well, you need to go somewhere else, you know, go somewhere else, get on stage, make jokes, write. Keep doing it, and eventually it'll build to something. And I think most comedians would tell you that you shouldn't expect anything out of stand-up comedy for at least 10 years because it is a very saturated market, and people have been working at it their whole lives. You know, mm-hmm. most of the comics that your audience or you know as household names, they've been at it for a good majority of their lives at this point. That's a solid 20 years until an overnight success happens. Mm-hmm. And so now that I'm, you know, coming up over 10 years now, I felt compelled to get to this point where I can record an hour of comedy. And I need that because everything is about the proof of, you got to have video evidence of high quality to convince bookers and create an audience and let them know that you're someone worth coming to see. Mm-hmm. It takes a long time to build something like that. So I'm glad that I've stuck with it because I'm starting to see returns. And being able to have random opportunities where, you know, when I first sought out a career in comedy, I never would have thought I would be doing some of the stuff that I do now. And just sitting here at a local radio station in a place so far away from my home, I'm elated to be here with you. So I really appreciate you letting me talk with you for a little while.
Well, when we met, I could tell immediately that you were a person that knew how to talk. I mean, we got off and just started talking and talking, and you're very easy to carry a conversation with, and I'm excited to come see your show on Thursday. I think it's going to be very good.
I'm really hoping that the people of Spokane will come out in the way that their general energy. I've been standing out in front of the marquee at the Garland Theater with this silly sign that I made that was like, you know, this Thursday, come check out the show, whatever. I've been pointing at the marquee, pointing at me, pointing at cars in the intersection, saying, y'all, Thursday, come on. And so many people here have been way, I'm surprised. Only two people have flipped me off so far. So that's, that was a win for me. So many people have been like, awesome, man, honking, giving me the hang loose sign pieces. And so many people pulling back around the block to scan this QR code that I have on it to find out more information. Like, people seem like they're genuinely excited, and the energy that I'm getting back from these people here in this nice little town, I believe that we're gonna get what we need to get a nice hour of stand-up comedy captured on film, and I'm hoping I can use that to propel me even further than I've gotten myself now. So,
and that neighborhood, it is a little gem. I mean, I live up there, and I've just found that there is such a strong sense of community amongst the people there. And, you know, despite its many flaws, Spokane is a place that I've always found people to be mostly supportive.
Totally.
And mutually committed to watching other people succeed. And, I mean, and that was how I made my introduction to you, was just seeing you out there with the sign in the rain, I would like to add, that there was nothing that was going to stop you, and you were out there promoting it. And I was just, I was already dying laughing, because, I mean, I was just like, look at this guy who's out there giving it his all to make sure that he reaches as many people as possible. And it takes a large amount of commitment and determination and doggedness to do that. So
I have my back up against the wall right now, and it's crunch time. You know, I a series of events and just my life in general, everything just feels so serendipitous, and the people in my life that have supported me from the beginning, when I first was sharing with my friends and family that I was going to do this, they're still here. And the guy that is coming up with a film crew from Los Angeles to film this for me is a guy I went to high school with in a small town in Kansas. Mm-hmm. When I first told him, he also was one of my roommates in college up in Lawrence, Kansas. And him and another one of my good friends, they both went to film school at KU, and they both pursued film in Los Angeles. They left and I stayed, and I was working in a restaurant, in a bar, two bars, like just kind of working like four nights a week, one bar one night, one bar another night, and two nights like Friday, Saturday at that nice restaurant. And I had more money than I could have possibly needed to live in a place that had minimal cost of living. Mm-hmm. And it got real easy to get real comfortable. And after a while, I realized like I had everything that a person could want or need. I had a 6,000 piece vinyl record collection, and I just, you know, just, I love music. I was so into it. I had all this stuff that I just had, a little drum kit, some guitars, some keys, just like hanging out, making music that I wasn't very good at making, but I had access.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it was fun. I was trying to make stuff, but I really wasn't making anything of it. I didn't have enough. There wasn't enough about music that I know so many talented musicians from that town, particularly. It's a music town. Mm-hmm. And just knowing the dedication and how much time they'd put into their craft, it didn't come to me naturally. And something like being a jokester and trying to get people to laugh, I've done that my whole life. And when I happened upon an opportunity at an open mic in that college town that I'd been in a thousand times before, never once had I seen this once a month, last Sunday, open mic. And I watched four or five guys I'd known from being a townie in this place for mm-hmm. such a long time get up on stage and just eat it, you know? And I was like, I could probably eat it just like that.
Yeah.
You know,
and
I got
fun.
Up. Yeah, I got up and talked about the squirrels that were in my walls for 5 minutes and got more laughs than anybody, and was like, you know what? I like that.
That's a good feeling.
Yeah. And then I started going to Kansas City twice a week, which is like a 70-mile drive. You know, it added up quick as far as like gas mileage, and I was only getting 3-minute sets. And after I did that for about 2 months, I was like, if I want to get better at this, I need more stage time. I want to do this every day. Mm-hmm. And so I got my wheels turning, and my friends, the guys that I used to room with that were out in Los Angeles chasing their dreams, I told them, I was like, hey guys, I started doing comedy. They were like, good. Do that. Mm-hmm. Get out of Lawrence, man. You've got so much more potential. That's a perfect fit for you. And I made my way out to a real sad 3 months in Los Angeles where I just couldn't get on stage or whatever. But I had been through San Francisco a couple times. I drove around the country for a little bit. I'd sold all of my stuff within 4 months of doing my first stand-up comedy set. And I sold everything to just pursue this. Threw it in the back of my 2004 Honda Civic. She's purring like a brand new baby kitten still, you know? She's beautiful. You know,
so keep going.
You know what kittens sound like. She's struggling. But it's okay. That guy, Trent Eubin, he's a good man. He's helping me out a lot. He owns his own production company in Los Angeles now, and he's watched me from the beginning, and I finally got to a point where I'm like, I'm ready, man. Can you help me? And he has the ability to, and he's extending himself, bringing up a camera crew and doing it out of pocket, because I definitely can't afford how much money it's going to take to produce this quality video. Mm-hmm. And to know that people like that are still in my life and want to see me succeed, and coming out here in Spokane, not knowing if anybody's going to come, you know, I came out here a week early because ticket sales are a lot lower than I wanted them to be. And so getting out there on the corner and just trying to let people know that, like, this means a lot to me. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be a big determining factor of whether or not we get what we want. We're trying to put 300 people in there. That'll look real clean in that beautiful traditional theater in there.
It is a beautiful
theater. It's so gorgeous. And I'm just so stoked. And the guy that's running it, Josiah Carlson, a local comedian, when I first reached out in like a booking network on Facebook, you know, there's a lot of, every city has a different booking thing usually on Facebook where you kind of just let people know, hey, I'm coming into town. These are my credits. Here's a video. If you've got stage time, whatever. At the beginning of this year, I knew that I wanted to, at some point, record an hour. And I did not know where to do it, who was going to let me do it. And I had initially set it up to do it down in Los Angeles with that production company, but the venue didn't get locked down. And I had reached out to so many people, this place being one of them, where I was set to do this initially in June at the Garland. But Josiah, he reached back out to me after I had lost that venue in LA. And he said, hey man, I know I had you booked here, but we just started the series and there's not been a much promotion behind it yet. I really like your comedy. I want to try and give you the best size audience that I can. Can we push down the road to September? And I said, actually, that could be really cool. And I headlined a show out here a couple months ago in Pasco, Washington, just about 2 hours south. And I was like, let me, after that show, I'm going to come up and check out the venue, make sure it's a good space for me. And I came up here, walked into the space, beautiful. The GM there, Jasmine, very nice person, very helpful. And they were all super like, we're excited to have you if you want to come do it. And so I picked from that, and then I watched the Super Mario Brothers movie, and then I drove home, you know, and I've been anticipating this. I've ran this hour about 40 times in this year, and it keeps getting tighter and better. And, I'm just ready to do it, record it, let it be a thing so that I can move forward. I mean, it took me 10 years to get to this point. My goal is after we finish this, to do it again in 2 years. I'd like to, from this point forward, about every 2 years, I'd like to be recording a new hour of comedy, hopefully until I die, mm-hmm. you know, because I love this. It's so much fun. And I do think that like this will give me access to better and bigger opportunities where I believe that the money's going to come. I have my hands in a few different buckets, just a lot of projects. You have to have multiple things. I make art that I sell after my shows. It's changed my life. You know, I'm peddling stuff all the time. It's not just the sign out in front of the marquee. After the show, I got a briefcase full of collage art prints that I sell pretty well. My favorite compliment that I usually get about my art is better than I expected. Ah. So, you know.
Ringing.
Yeah, it's great. And I'm just really grateful for all the people right now that have been giving me positive energy, because I was definitely feeling a little worried. But I think that everything's going to work out nicely. And I think that there's going to be a nice crowd there. And I'm ready to give them a show.
And we're ready to have it. It's really good. Spokane's really, really, really happy to have you, Jordan. And I'm happy to have you on my show today. We're going to take a real quick break, and then we're going to be back speaking to Jordan Sermonera about his upcoming comedy special at the Garland Theater this Thursday at 6:30. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Tess, and I like dragonflies because I love doing quizzes to see how much I know about a topic. Tune in on Dragonflies on Thin Air every Sunday at 3 o'clock on KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.
You're listening to Solidarity Spokane, KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Happy Labor Day. I'm your host, Kat Sabotage, and I'm here in the studio with comedian Jordan Sermonera discussing his latest comedy special that is going to be at the Garland Theater this Thursday, September 7th at 6:30. He's set to record his much-anticipated debut comedy album, Cutting It Up, and we've been talking about his journey into comedy and kind of what propelled him to get started. And Jordan, one of the questions that I wanted to ask you, for listeners at home who have that dream, who have that passion or that love, but are afraid of the economic situation that they're in. I mean, you've taken a huge risk. You know, you, like you said, I mean, it takes a lot to step out onto that branch and to sell all your stuff and to say, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to do it. And it requires, you know, more bravery than I ever had when I was thinking about maybe going into acting or any other kind of art. And it can be intimidating. How was there a particular like aha moment that sticks out to you? Or was there like a moment like that you can clearly envision where you went, can't, gotta go. I absolutely have to jump out onto this ledge and see where I go.
That I was telling you about, the restaurant that I worked at in Lawrence, where I was making a pretty good living. And it was one of those places where when I got there, it had a really good reputation. And through the 5 years that I was there, we had four different owners and five different general managers, like a restaurant on fire. You know, it was, it was at one point a $2.2 million restaurant that, that owner who had gotten up to that, he gave it to his son after he had come down with Alzheimer's, and that guy ran it down and sold it for 200 grand.
Ooh.
So it was real bad. Yeah. And just watching them kind of flail, and they kept bringing in people with like less and less relevant experience for GM position, you know,
And the meat grinder.
Just couldn't, I couldn't take any of those people seriously because they were not connected to the space. They didn't really understand how to run the restaurant or a restaurant in general. And after I had gotten myself into doing some stand up like 2-3 times a week, I felt like I had some purpose for the first time. And my attitude towards this manager that I just did not respect was really starting to come out without any filter.
I think a lot of listeners can relate to that.
Yeah.
Having a manager that kind of just makes you bite through your tongue almost entirely.
And I just kind of started, I stopped biting the tongue, you know, and I was just kind of mouthing off and
freedom of speech at work.
Yeah.
No.
We had a little conversation one day about my attitude, and about 2 weeks later, we had another conversation where I came in on my day off and I knew what was going on. It was February 13th 2013, the day before Valentine's Day. And we sat down. And he was like, you know, we had a conversation about your attitude. Doesn't seem like it's changed much. And I was like, no, it hasn't.
I just love me so much.
Yeah.
That's my gift to myself, yeah, is Valentine's Day.
And so he let me go that day. And when I lost that job, I had nothing to lose. So that's what it was. By a month, little over a month later, I left April 5th or 6th of 2013 and just set out with no real plan. I was going to end up at my friend's house in Los Angeles at some point, but I traveled through 10 states, 16 cities with not enough money to make it there, but I made it work somehow. And I was just doing as many open mics as I could and as many towns as I could find where I knew people. You know, I grew up in Kansas, but my parents met in the Marine Corps and they're from two different parts of the country. And I went to college where other people had gone off to other cities. I had friends and family dispersed across the entire country. So I had a lot of places to stay throughout 16 cities and 10 states. And then I wound up in San Francisco where I was like, this is where I think I can really spread my wings, if you will, and start to try and figure it out. And I had a bunch of odd jobs while I was there. I went back to waiting tables as little as I possibly could. You mm-hmm. know, that's what was most important was like, yeah, okay, comedy isn't going to bring in enough money to feed me and house me, especially in San Francisco, California. But I definitely got into some places where you have to be willing to sacrifice certain things if you want to like make that kind of stuff. I was living in a very dirty place for $650 a month in the mm-hmm. Outer Sunset of San Francisco. It was old and out in the deep 40s of the Outer Sunset, very out by the ocean. And it was a rent-controlled apartment that I did not realize until towards the end of that 2 years of living there. I was paying the entire rent. And I was like, oh, man, I got here, didn't I? You know. But then I ended up moving in with my now best friend and his brother. We started a comedy show together. It's just you just kind of got to keep creating opportunities for yourself. I think the one thing if you are thinking about doing stand-up is to know that no one cares. And you're going to have to do it for you. And you can't really take anyone's attitudes or opinions about you in these little comedy communities. They're just like any other job. People are always like, what's it like doing stand-up? It's like any other job. Mm-hmm. There's politics. There's people you love. There's people you hate. There's people that you just can't seem to get along with. There's people that reach out beyond what they need to help you. It's like anything else. And navigating it is a little different because you, for the first few years, are going to be working for tip money and drink tickets and slices of pizza. You know, it's not real glorious until it is. And I'm not quite to the glory yet, but I have gotten to a point where I'm making just as much money as I was when I was waiting tables 4 days a week. And that's for me to not have to go back to that. Like I've lived hand to mouth my whole life. Mm-hmm. So being able to do this and actually doing what I want to do, It is fulfilling, but it is also very hard. You know, like I am everything. I am the entire business. I have to film myself. I have to edit that video. I have to post it on social media. I have to keep my schedule up on my website. No one's helping me do this. And so it's more work than I've ever done in my life. And a lot of people would laugh at that concept, but it's hard to create a brand for yourself. You're selling yourself. And I think at this point, it's the only thing that I believe in is like, I know that this is what I want and this is what I can do. And so after you have that, I think it's about the mentality and the perseverance. There's so many people that are not good at comedy in the beginning and they just keep going. And one day they're funny. They figured it out. It's about trusting yourself and figuring out what's funny to you and not trying to write jokes for other people, write jokes for the people that you resonate with. Mm-hmm. Humor is very subjective. You're never going to get everybody to laugh in the room. It's just not possible. There's no joke in the world where there isn't someone that's like, that's not funny. It's just,
or offended and having an issue.
Exactly. Yeah. When it's maybe it is offensive. Maybe it's not. It's your perspective. So, finding your audience, I think, is the biggest challenge in comedy, and I'm still doing it. But I think in the past, 7-8 months, I've really I've gotten more time to have more time on stage, people getting to know me a little bit more. I have a hard time really feeling like I can connect with an audience in under 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. I really don't like doing comedy for less than 15 minutes anymore. But in Portland, where I live now, there's a lot of shows every week, a lot of comics, local shows, bar shows, pizza shops, restaurants, outside shows, like anywhere an owner of an establishment will let a bunch of degenerate people plug a microphone in, we will do comedy to whoever will show up or might just happen to be there and didn't even know a comedy show. Comedy happens to people a lot, mm-hmm. you know? And so finding those opportunities to get more time has been really integral into me becoming what I am now. And I do feel like I am a competent comedian. I can hold a room's attention, whether or not they like me or not.
They're watching and they're listening.
They're watching and they're listening, you know, but I, and the more and more I lean into my voice, and like, I got so self-conscious early in comedy because you do comedy for the first few years to just comedians. You're doing open mics and there's no one there that wants to be there as an audience. They'll leave pretty quick when they find out that are an open mic. Some people are adventurous. They'll stick around and watch just a train wreck.
I'm one of those people.
Yeah.
I enjoy those.
It's fun to watch if you can put yourself mentally through it and be in the right space to like watch an open mic all 3 hours of 40 comedians doing 4 minutes or whatever. If you can't do that, you leave. But the idea of performing to other people that are trying to do the same thing that you're trying to do, there is this sense of no one's trying to give you any affirmation to do any of this, because then it's stage time out of their stage time.
Right.
The mm-hmm. more people there are, the less time everybody gets. So if you're trying to get into it, make sure that you're writing jokes for audiences, the people that you want to make laugh. Don't try and make comedians laugh, because it's just not going to help you.
That's been Jordan Sermonera. He has a comedy special this Thursday, September 7th. Doors at 6:30. I believe the performance is at 8.
I think the show's supposed to start at 7:30. Local host Josiah Carlson, the guy who is producing it, he's going to do a short set up front. And then there is a semi-local comedian, Amy 8, who will probably do 15 to 20 minutes. And then I am going to shoot for an hour and 15 minutes that I am going to whittle down to an hour-long special. And then a 44-minute LP, a vinyl that I'm going to try and sell to Sirius XM. So
if comedy's your thing, it's at the Garland Movie Theater this Thursday. Jordan, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Dallin.
You've been listening to Solidarity Spokane, KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. This is Kat, signing off. Have a good week, everybody.
The following program was pre-recorded.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! Today, a Labor Day special.
The person who called me was unlike most of the workers who called. He wasn't from Mississippi or Louisiana. He wasn't either white, black, or Latino. He was an Indian man flown in from India, calling from the Mississippi Gulf Coast. And I thought, what was an Indian man doing coming here to clean up after Hurricane Katrina?
We'll speak to longtime immigrant labor organizer Saket Soni about how immigrant workers have been lured to the United States and trapped in forced labor to rebuild communities after climate disasters. Then we'll go to Salvadoran poet and writer Javier Zamora, author of